7, contact tower 128.15.
Caution, caution. Manual, fuel, manual, fuel.
I'm John Golia.
I'm Greg Fife.
And I'm Todd Cruz.
And we are the Flight Safety Detectives.
Between us, we have over a century of aviation accident investigation and safety experience to draw on as we discuss issues that affect all of us.
So we are qualified to share our perspectives on accidents and incidents and what can be learned from them for the future.
We're proud to say we've got three sponsors that really relate to the topic of aviation safety: the Professional Aviation Maintenance Association, or PAMA, Piston Power, and Avemco Insurance, a world-class provider of aviation insurance.
Later on in the show, we'll tell you how you can get a 5% discount on your insurance just for listening to the show.
We don't just dissect the official reports. In every episode, we identify safety issues and take the mystery out of accident investigations.
So maybe pilots and their planes can have safer flights ahead.
Well, hello, gentlemen. It is another special edition of Flight Safety Detectives. We are recording this because we've gotten some responses from our previous show regarding the preliminary report that had been issued by the India government on Air India Flight 171. And while we have had thousands of comments in a variety of different forms, and I've also received a number of comments on some Facebook posts that I put out over the weekend. It is, it's one of those things, John, that you used to write an article called Torqued. Well, I think the three of us are torqued over, one, some of the comments, especially by those people who are probably non-pilots, two, by people that hold a pilot's license in their pocket and now think that they're aircraft accident investigators or subject matter experts, or three, even by some safety investigators or accident investigators who are coming up with ridiculous pet theories or at least throwing shade when the logic just isn't there. And I know that there were a number of comments about me being hard on people. What do you mean hard on people? We're a month into this. We do have some factual information, and we have to take the facts that are written on that piece of paper called the prelim report as facts. So based on those facts, regardless of whether those facts have been manipulated by the Indian government before they put them on the paper, regardless of that, those are facts. And when they say that the fuel control switches were moved from one position to another and then back to another position, and the only way by design those switches can move is if a human has moved them, because there is no other way, not ones or zeros. There is no digital fault or flaw that would have moved the physical switch. And for them to say the physical switch had been moved, and the fact that those engines, the fuel supply was cut off, those engines spooled down, and then somebody tried to put the switch back in the run position, that is a physical, intentional act. That's not accidental, not in any way, shape, or form, because the design of the switch is meant to prevent accidental movement of the switch. It takes a human intervention to make them move. It is an intentional movement. That is, it's an intentional act that a human has to manipulate that switch. They cannot manipulate it on their own by design. And ones and zeros, because that switch does send an electric current to a motor that controls the valve, there is no physical way, nor is there logic. So I'll throw this out because we talked about this. Let's say those switches never moved. They were always in the run position. And somehow there was an electrical anomaly or gremlin in the wiring between the switch and the fuel valve. And let's say those fuel valves closed and the engines shut down. How is it then, and this is based on the information in the preliminary report, how is it then that fuel flow automatically started again, that those valves just magically opened and allowed fuel to go to the engine, and the start sequence was able to begin its process and at least get one engine firing up and starting to spool up? How would that be if you had an electrical anomaly that shut the valve off? There's no logic there. So when we get all of these comments and all of these new superstar investigators out there, or they criticize me for being too hard on people, I'm talking logic. We are talking about, you know, better than 200 people dying in an aircraft accident, and people want to debate semantics. People want to debate the fact that, you know, couldn't have been the pilots. There's only two people in that cockpit as we know it right now. There could have been 10 for all we know, but the Indian government has only said basically there's two, the pilot and the co-pilot. So based on that factual information, there's only two people in that cockpit. And for somebody like the pilot union or someone else to say, well, the pilots didn't know that the switches went to cutoff. How would they not know? Logic says they had to know. Someone had to know. And in fact, it is a typical response. Todd, we had this conversation. If you have a pilot who says, why did you go to cutoff? That means someone observed something to then cue them to ask that question. Why did you do that? Now, the response back was, of course, I didn't do that. Whether that was a true response or a cover response, we don't know that. But now, the fact is, an action had to have been taken to cue a pilot to ask that question.
We've had several questions in the comments. We've had hundreds of comments already from our most recent episode. And part of them involve that. Well, let me answer some of those questions indirectly. Yes, it is possible that the same person who moved the switches said the comment. But according to the facts in the preliminary report, they implied that two different people said those comments. Why did you do that? No, I didn't. So to say that the pilots didn't know what was going on, only if they didn't understand how the airplane operates. And those two switches in question are so fundamental that I'm just about absolutely certain that if the pilots knew that that switch was pulled, that they knew that the engine would be losing fuel and cutting off. That's one thing. And you mentioned also comments from pilot unions, and there's other comments from Boeing and from Air India itself. The CEO of Air India said a few things. And I'll just say this. It is a preliminary report. There are a lot of questions that are unanswered. The CEO of Air India said there were some unanswered questions. I agree with them. I also have to say that so far, those questions have not been directly answered by the investigative authorities, and they have some more things they should do. With respect to who said what in the cockpit, I say that there was a two-hour cockpit voice recorder. The entire 2 hours should be transcribed, including the time before the pilots got into the cockpit, so they can answer definitively for themselves, for us, and for anyone who's asking questions out there. Who was in the cockpit when? What did they say? And can any of it or all of it be associated with actions that were recorded by the flight data recorder or actions that have been proven by other means? I'm not saying they have to identify them by name, but they do have to say this is distinct human being number one, this is distinct human being number two, or whatever way they need to. But that's a question that can and should be answered.
And John, you know, one of the comments that came back was something that we had talked about as far as in-flight air start. And this is an all-electric airplane. And so when those engines shut down, you had mentioned that typically, and this is true of just about almost all airplanes except for this one, that pneumatic air is used to get the rotation started as a start for this airplane. And while that statement from a textbook standpoint needs to be corrected, there is basically airflow going through that engine. But these engines, because they use an electrical starter, that electrical starter is powered by the APU. So when the sequence of cutoff, where the fuel switches went to cutoff, the APU door opened and the automatic start sequence for the APU started because it's anticipating we got an engine issue. We produce the power. The APU produces the voltage necessary to crank those engines because the rat can't do it. It doesn't produce enough electrical power. And in fact, the rat really only powers captain instruments, navigation and communication radios, and flight control systems. So again, when we look at the start sequence, and you've dissected this now, the start sequence doesn't happen in a matter of seconds.
Oh, it takes about a minute and a half. All right. So when you command a start, and I haven't been able to find out whether the APU will automatically crank up when you select the start. I don't believe it does, but that's yet to be determined.
I think it does, John, unless you have external power.
So, and let's talk about the reason for that first off. The generator that's on the auxiliary power unit is big, because to start these engines takes a lot of electricity. That's why they don't start it on batteries.
Yeah.
Batteries don't have enough power to start these engines. So they have to have a big generator out there pumping out a lot of kVAs in order to get these engines going.
And when you have that a time lapse, because these engines don't just spool up, I mean, like you said, a minute and a half, 2 minutes, it has to go through a sequence. So if anybody that's ever sat at the gate and listened to the engine start is a passenger, you hear the engine start to spool up. You'll know when basically fuel is introduced. It fires off and the engine is continuing to spool. That doesn't happen in a matter of seconds. That in this case, it's a minute and a half to 2 minutes. That's a long time. Well, this airplane was only in the air, what, Todd? 30 seconds, 36 seconds, somewhere around there. So these engines didn't even have a chance to get really spooled up. One, number one, from what the prelim report said, indicates that it was in the process of now spooling up, not to any kind of speed that would produce any kind of thrust for sustained flight. And that number two, you know, hadn't really gotten off the start blocks, if you will. And so they just didn't have any time. But, you know, some of the comments that we've read, not only through Flight Safety Detectives, but other people's websites and YouTube channels and some of the commentary, doesn't make logical sense. And one of the things that we do on this show, because we do have sources of information that'll just about 99.8% of all of these other folks don't have, we can verify and vet a lot of information. Plus, the biggest thing is we have experience. I mean, I spent, 18 months in Indonesia going through an intentional act. I know that with Egypt Air, it was an intentional act. And for people to go, I can't believe a pilot would do this. Well, we've seen historically that pilots will do intentional things. German Wings, Silk Air, Egypt Air, PSA, where we had a disgruntled employee shoot the pilots and that kind of stuff. You have people that will do these things for whatever reason. We don't know those reasons. We don't know what the triggers are. But the fact is that while we want to believe that it's just unconscionable that a pilot or pilots would do something nefarious, look at MH370. We're still talking about that today because that was an intentional act as well. You just don't know what these triggers are. And I get spooled up over some of the ridiculous comments. We got one through Flight Safety Detectives where somebody is trying to draw a link between the price of gold, the price of Boeing stock, and this accident. I mean, I will give them an A-plus for creativity, but there is just no substantiation or logic behind that. And it's very frustrating because these kinds of things mislead the uneducated public. And I'm not talking school education. I'm talking about people that don't really understand aviation. Yet you have a lot of people that are sounding off as though they are experts, producing just ridiculously wild stuff that makes no logical sense.
And at this point, I'd like to address another issue. Actually, many comments that we've had that we've been unnecessarily harsh in talking about indirectly some of the other producers of content out there. Yes, we have been harsh. That said, speaking personally, I've been putting out things as someone inside the business for over two decades now. And sometimes I need to have some, how should I say it, some schooling and correction in what I say.
Yeah. But
not because I'm intentionally trying to do something. And for those of you who are putting out stuff that sometimes get us going, look, I actually look at a lot of that stuff. Sometimes I really like what I see. Sometimes I don't. And I'll say that with rare exceptions, I'm talking about conspiracy theory type places where people are deliberately putting on garbage. Even the ones that are notorious for being opinionated and wrongheaded and sometimes and whatnot are sometimes on the money. So my comment is, if we do make a comment, yeah, we probably have something good to say to you about your work at the same time. We may not say it in that show, but we're looking at you because we want to learn more, and we'll take it from any corner we can.
But I get on my high horse because when you have a lot of people come out 2 hours, 5 hours, 12 hours after an accident and say, the crew didn't set the flaps. How do you know that? You looked at one frame of a video and you said that the flaps weren't set, and then you build a whole storyline for a month only to be proven wrong. Because one, I mean, I knew the flaps were down. I blew those videos up on a big screen TV. You could see the slats out. If the slats are out, there's at least one setting of flaps. And if you understand how Fowler flaps work, as we've talked about in previous shows. So you have to do your homework. You have to vet before you say anything. And, you know, when you have so-called experts, especially pilots who fly these types of airplanes, make these statements and then try to stand by them for a month only to be proven wrong, it's like they built a whole storyline about how bad the crew was and not following checklists or doing something stupid. From that particular standpoint, as we've talked about before, you can't move beyond the electronic checklist because when it calls for flaps, the checklist logic monitors whether or not you've actually put those flaps in that position. And you can't move through the checklist unless you do that. So there are these safeguards. So if you understand the system, then you put things in context and you put out correct information, or at least factual information. What we said was, yes, the flaps were in a position along with the slats. We didn't know if that flap setting was proper because we didn't know what the weight of the aircraft was, and did they have bad information? Did they have a bad flap setting and a bad thrust setting because of the length of the runway? Now we have some now context, and the Indian government has said that the flaps were set for the weight that was entered. Okay, great. Now we've put that little issue to bed. Now we know that the flaps were out, the slats were set, the takeoff for all intent and purposes while the airplane was still on the runway was good to go. It was normal. It was ops normal. But once that airplane broke ground, now all of a sudden, and we can't even refer to this as an accident anymore, it's an event sequence. Because accident implies that, you know, there were errors and that kind of stuff, and people want to continue to mix messages like we talked about in a previous show. These are not engine failures. This wasn't an intentional shutdown because somebody moved those fuel switches to the cutoff position. That's intentional. That's a conscious act. The engines didn't fail because of a mechanical malfunction or failure or an anomaly. They lost fuel because somebody moved the switch to off. So they aren't failures. And the restart sequence that eventually occurred automatically because the logic in the airplane said, okay, we got a problem with an engine. Doesn't know what kind of problem other than the fact that the engine is spooling down, and it's going to try and do whatever it takes to get it relit again. But
well,
again,
once the crew member selected relight. So
correct.
We don't even know if they were taken off with the the igniters and continuous.
Yeah, right? There's, so, yeah.
There's so much in there. There's so much in there that's not said. And you know what I noticed in listening today to a whole bunch of brand new experts that are now all over the internet, at least six new ones today that I've seen, is nobody does the timeline. All right, seconds matter. And you go down with everything that you know from the time the airplane started to move from the gate, taxi time, right, time to the end of the runway, takeoff time, what happened every second along the way that you can identify. Nobody's been doing that. We did it, and we continue. We just did it before the show to confirm some numbers because we got some additional numbers from another source, right, and just to make sure that, what we had was accurate.
You know, one of the things that you brought up earlier, Todd, off the air, is that we do not script this show. There are a lot of shows out there that are very well done, very well produced, but, you know, they're heavily or highly scripted. We have never scripted a show. We get on, we talk about subjects, we talk about issues, we talk about facts like this prelim. And we talk from experience. We talk from the fact that we analyzed what was in the report, what wasn't in the report. We're not speculating. I mean, the fact that the switch has moved, that's a fact. It's a hard fact. Someone's used data to prove that, not only physical data, but also digital data from the EAFR. The fact is that someone physically moved those switches. That's not us speculating. And again, when they go, well, you don't know the pilots did that. Who else would have done it? There's only technically two people in there unless we're told otherwise. And only a human can move that switch. So how is it from a logic standpoint that they just met? What happened? So to say that you're speculating that a pilot did it, who else would have done it?
We're going to take a short break now to meet one of Avemco's employees from their Frederick, Maryland office.
What's the most challenging calls that you have had?
The most challenging calls that we can get here are senior pilots that aren't qualified, that haven't flown 25 hours or more in the last 12 months, and they don't meet our underwriting guidelines. And so those can be very challenging because you feel for them, but at the same time, you have to abide by our guidelines.
And so are they always trying to, you know, finesse you and go, well, but I will, or I did, or, I mean, what do you require for them to prove that they've either flown those 25 hours or will fly those 25 hours for your underwriting?
Well, they tell us, you know, we take their word of mouth. So they tell us we're going to trust them. We're going to believe them. You know, they're going to have current flight review, valid medicals, you know, at least 25 hours. And then there's some that don't have it. They go get it. They call back.
What about the funniest phone call you've ever had where you just started laughing because the information that you got is like, there's just no way I could do anything for this person?
Well, I had a guy that called in one time, and we have basic questions that we ask. Have you had any accidents? Have you had any incidents or claims, DUIs, arrests? And when I asked that question, he said, well, yes, I used my plane to smuggle cocaine back in 1988. And I got real quiet. You could hear a pin drop, and I said, are you serious? And he said, no, I'm just messing with you. It's freaking.
So, Judd, to write him?
I think we quoted him, but if we were too high, I can't remember the place. It was a few years ago.
Yeah, well, carrying that caught, kind of cargo, I can imagine the premium was real high.
It caught me off guard. I was like, some people are brutally honest, and some people just like to pull your list. So, yeah. At the end of the day, it was fun.
Can they still get insurance if they have a minor landing accident?
Yes, they certainly can. As long as it's outside 36 months, we'll take a look at everything. And
do you require them to demonstrate that they've either had recurrent training after their incident or accident? Is there any criteria? You know, because a lot of times, you know, if the FAA doesn't require a 709 ride, just a, you know, refresher or check ride, do you all require that before you'll underwrite somebody that had an incident or an accident?
We don't require you, but there's some people that do it, you know, and they'll call back and they're like, hey, I got 20 hours of dual, you know, I'm ready to go, and we'll re-underwrite it and we'll offer coverage because that is a great thing to say.
Great. How long have you been here, Justin?
About 5 years.
And what's the best part of your job?
The best part of the job is being able to travel to go to air shows like Oshkosh, Sun and Fun, being able to meet our customers, you know, face to face, give them free things. You know, I'm always taking money from them. It's nice to be able to get them something, you know.
Yeah. Well, that's
other free little good.
Yeah, there's a good tag on it. When was the last time your insurance company gave you something other than a bill?
Yeah. So we try to do things, but it's fun to do that.
You got a hat.
You got a hat. It's fun to go to those shows because you get to meet the customers, and when you meet them face to face, it's just like you've known them for a long time, and then you establish those connections over years, and they call back and, hey, I remember you.
And now, back to the flight safety detectives.
Now, there's a lot of speculation out there, sometimes from official or professional bodies. For example, there was a quote from the Indian Pilots Union. Can't remember the name of the union right now, but the quote was something effective. This was besmirching the reputation of the pilots. The preliminary report was not there to lay blame or to besmirch reputations, nor is it ours. But if we have a report that says a human being pulled the switch from run to cutoff, that's not besmirching reputation. That's relaying the fact that a particular act took place. We don't know why it took place. We may never know why it took place. That's the job of the investigation, and we hope that it is fully executed by the Indian authorities. And as I stated earlier, that the other parties to the investigation have full access to bring their expertise to bear on this to make sure that as much clarity as possible is given to both the accident investigations and to the public at large.
And one of the things that we've talked about in the past, and I continually harp on, is the fact that we weren't getting information from day one. It was few and far between. Again, I've been in those situations when the investigation takes a different direction and information is held close to the vest for a reason. And that's what I had suspected early on. But I don't talk about it because, again, without being there and actually having all of the data to support or at least verify what I believe, I'm not going to talk about that this was at that time, early on in the investigation, anything where an intentional event took place. We finally got some factual information to actually verify or vet what we suspected and now can confirm. But there was an article written, the Wall Street Journal basically said that the NTSB investigative team was willing to basically tell the Indian government we're done because it lacked transparency as far as releasing information. We were all anticipating and expecting information. And when nothing comes out and you have a void for 30 days, regardless of what ICAO Annex 13 says about releasing preliminary information within the 30 days, the fact is that we didn't know if this was a flight safety issue with an aircraft, with an engine, or even the flight crew as far as procedures, policies and procedures by the airline itself. To have nothing come out created just a trove of speculation built on not even factoids. It was, you know, little tidbits here and there based on a video or two videos and things like that. And of course, you know, what we were trying to do was take those same videos and just factually walk through. Well, the airplane took off. Okay, great. It looked like it used the majority of the runway, which it did. The airplane got airborne, but the flight path caused, you know, I said it was starting to settle, which means the power was off that airplane, off those engines early on. It's been now confirmed. We've been able to put a timeline together. Todd, you did a good job in doing that, in looking at when the RAT deployed. Well, the RAT deployed as soon as those fuel cutoff switches went to cutoff. So now we can put a whole sequence of events together and put some context. We can't put a lot of context to it because, as you brought up earlier in our conversation, Todd, you know, we know what happened factually because we get it off the flight data recorder as the Indian government has presented it in the report. We don't know why it happened. We don't know why one pilot did this and one pilot responded like this and one pilot then took another action, and one pilot made a mayday call. We don't know who it was, and we don't know why they did it. But we do know that we have two engines that were shut down, didn't have sufficient time to spool up and flight to be sustained before they collided with trees in a number of buildings. All we're trying to do is understand whether or not this is an accident where there are safety of flight issues that need to be corrected by an airline, an operator, if you will, a regulator, a certifying authority. We don't know. But now, based on this factual information, this transitions from an accident to possibly a criminal act, an intentional act that takes on a different complexion as far as the investigative process. And again, you know, people get all wound up about, we're just talking facts. But a lot of people are building a variety of different storylines that just don't make logical sense. If you're going to at least fantasize about a pet theory or whatever, at least have it, you know, make some logical sense. But, and that's what we're trying to do is just correct it, because it's a disservice to put out, you know, well, you know, the price of Boeing stock and the price of gold, you know, had something to do with this. Really? How do you tie that together? I still don't understand how you tie all that together. And then there's a lot of people think that this is a conspiracy for the United States to cover Boeing and or the FAA. And that's just simply not the case, because I think the Indian government, if that were the case, the Indian government would want that to be known, that, hey, look, there is a problem with this airplane. There is a problem with the regulators. Why would the India government not at least present that if this was a cover-up and it was known? So,
and speaking of the Indian government, it's Monday afternoon in the United States, East Coast time, and the next move is in the hands of the Indian government. Will they be commenting on what they said in the preliminary report? Will they be providing more factual information? Or will they make an announcement saying that the character of this investigation is going in a particular direction? Whatever that direction may be, human error, deliberate action, mechanical problem, something. The next move is theirs, and we can only go through the data that's on the ground right now so much before we have to have something more. So, Indian government, yeah. Your turn.
And then, John, you know, one of the things that we talked about earlier was the fact that the FAA put out a statement regarding the SAIB that's referenced in the preliminary report, where they were finding issues with the fuel control switch, the detent, and that there were an issue, or at least issues that warranted an SAIB, which is not an AD. It's not an airworthiness directive. It wasn't mandated, but it was check this particular system because we had reports of issues. Well, they put that in the report. And of course, it had nothing to do with the 787, but the FAA put out a statement saying, yes, this pertains to 737, but doesn't really pertain to the 787. Now, one of the things that you and I and Todd talked about in a previous show was the fact that that quadrant, that thrust level quadrant with the fuel control switches had been replaced twice, or at least examined twice, back in 2019 and again in 2023.
The quadrant was replaced, we've been told.
And the question is why twice? What was going on that they had to do it twice? But you explained to me that, hey, even if it has nothing to do with the fuel control switches, they pull that whole quadrant out, they're going to examine it because they got to reinstall it correctly.
Or it's gone to another. They replaced it. As I understand, I haven't seen the documentation, but as it was explained, that quadrant was replaced twice over the life of this airplane, both times after that advisory came out. Right? One was a year after. I'll give them a little benefit of the doubt that it may have been through the shop before that year was up, because this isn't a type of component you're changing all the time. Right? But the second was second replacement was in 23. When that unit goes through the shop, they don't just fix one piece of that unit. They're going to look at it all. The service bulletin sits out there. The service bulletin is going to be part of the work package that somebody gets to take a look at this component. And they will then comply with that service bulletin in the shop, not on the airplane, in the shop. So that means when that module came out of the shop and ultimately went to this airplane, it had been checked in the shop in 2023. So I don't believe that there's an issue with the switches. Most people don't realize that, and to move these switches, you have to pull them out. There is some spring pressure on them to keep them in the detent. So you have to pull them up and then move them. It's easily explained as a bar across, and you have to pull the switch up over the bar and push it down on the other side. And if you're not paying attention, sometimes you'll put them right back in the same position you took them out of because you haven't moved it. So, and I wanted to raise another issue that somebody wrote in about a short circuit made these things move without the switch moving. So these valves are powered both ways. They power closed and they power open. No power, no movement. All right, so the switch is when it's up to open, there's power going to that electric motor that drives the valve. And it sits there just driving it open, essentially. And when you move the switch to off, it powers that same valve to off to cut off the fuel. So even if you had a short circuit, it would only move in one direction. You wouldn't be able to move it in two directions. We know it moved in two directions because after they attempted to do an engine start, the temperature started to rise on both engines. On one engine, it rose considerably, followed by the other one. Right, so we know that the valve went to open. It went to open.
And those are good points, John, because from an investigative standpoint, that's the logic I'm talking about, is understanding that kind of system and then how those valves, you look at the end result. The preliminary report says that the EGT started to rise. Well, the only way you get that is if you get fuel back introduced into the engine and that fuel is lit off and the engine is starting to turn. Again, because of the length of a start sequence, there wasn't sufficient time for it to spool up to an operating type speed for the pilots to be able to use it to sustain flight. But you have to keep these things in context. You can't just take them in isolation and then build a whole storyline around it because it just makes no logical sense. And I think that becomes a frustration for those of us that do this work and understand this work because we have to justify, well, if this happened, how did we get there? And when you're doing accident investigation, like I've said before, it's a very simple premise. You got to ask why until you can't ask why anymore. And usually you've gotten almost to the origin, pretty close. And in this case, if the switch is in the run position, then how did that valve close by itself? Well, if you got ones and zeros running through that line because of a short circuit, okay, that's great. That could answer one part of it, closing the valve. But then how did it magically open to allow fuel to go back to the engine for the restart to occur? If you already had a faulty circuit or a faulty wire that caused the valve to close in the first place, pilots couldn't do anything to make it. And then I think one of the comments was, well, maybe they cycled that switch when they realized that the engines, you know, had failed. Well, again, when you look at the data that has currently been presented, those engines were turning and burning. They were running. They didn't stop running until after the switch was moved. So from a logic standpoint, it wasn't that the engine shut down and then somebody moved the switch. It was the switch moved and the engine shut down. That's the detail. That's the timeline. Those are the things that we look at from an investigative standpoint. So when people come up with these wild theories, they just don't make logical sense. It's just very misleading. Especially for those like you, John, who on the maintenance side of the house know this and understand this And it's just frustrating that they, you know, people are just getting it wrong. And then that leads to bad information going to the general public.
And I think at this point, this might be a perfect opportunity for a second to last word. And I think our conversation back and forth, to me, it's pretty obvious what the second to last word is. To be continued. That's several words. But they're unresolved things here. They cannot be resolved further until action is taken by the investigative authorities and others involved in this. And I look forward to getting more insight, more data, as soon as possible from the authorities. And yes, I'm even looking for more opinions for those out there, from those out there. If it's a wild opinion, have some wild facts to back it up. If it's a reasoned opinion, have some reason to back it up.
Well said. And with that, John, we will leave you with our last word.
My last word would be to everybody out there that's spreading poor information, disinformation, to please stop. They're driving the passengers crazy. I've gotten a number of calls. I know you guys have as well. People saying, is it safe to fly on the 787? I'm flying next week. Is it safe to fly at all? My own daughter asked me that. Is it safe to even go fly herself, that she just had to take a flight? So really, I mean, putting this information out without properly vetting it yourself, you know, there's a lot of airline captains on there that I'm surprised with the comments they were passing. And the conclusions they were reaching about systems that they only know a little bit about. And I just want to close with this. Airplanes have become much more complicated over the last 50 years. Pilots may think they know their airplanes and know the systems, but they only know them from 50,000 feet view. You know, there's a reason why the flight manuals that come with the airplane are maybe only 10% the volume of material that the maintenance manuals have. Because these things are incredibly complicated, sometimes defy logic. If you try to run it, believing that you have a single wire system. And I can remember doing a number of accidents with pilots that were pretty sharp, but they could never get it through their head about different circuits, running two different electrical sources through the same wire, doing an and/or circuitry. And the list goes on, and I don't want to confuse our listeners with all that jargon, right? But just say that these airplanes are very, very complicated. It takes mechanics years to learn them, and yet pilots are flying the airplanes. That's what they get paid for, to fly, not to try to analyze the maintenance aspects of the airplane. And I see just today, I saw several videos where pilots were stepping off into the area that they have little or no expertise in, and they're spreading wrong information, and the general public is out there sucking it up.
Yeah.
So please, please, stick to what you know. If you don't know, don't put it out there.
Thank you so much for listening to the show. We really value all of our listeners and subscribers. Our podcast gets ranked by you. So if you like this, give us 5 stars inside your podcast platform.
We want to keep the conversation going with you. So we'd love for you to engage with us on our social media channels. We're on Instagram, X, Facebook, LinkedIn, and of course, YouTube.
You can email the show at flightsafetodetectives@gmail.com. By the way, if you're watching this on YouTube, we're working on growing this channel, and it really helps if you all comment. So please do that. We read them all.
And be sure to subscribe.
Without the right insurance, you're Sierra Oscar Lima. Vemco Insurance Company is the only direct writer in the market, never uses third-party agents or brokers. Instead, they connect you directly with real underwriters with real answers in their Frederick, Maryland office, ready to solve problems and approve coverage based on your flying. Floats to wheels and back to floats, Vemco gives you more flexibility. Call 888-879-0389 for a free quote or visit Vemco.com/flightsafety today. Don't forget to tell them the Flight Safety Detective sent you for 5% off your premium.